I think that that's what's interesting to me, is that audiences are very interested in sophisticated cinema, even if they don't realize it. And so what I try to do is capitalize on that possibility and say, hey, you might actually like this movie, even though you never would have considered paying attention to it unless I told you about it. And then, you know, by virtue of presenting that possibility, it feels like you're actually opening people up to senses they didn't realize were there.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, and you are listening to episode number 228 of the podcast. Thanks for streaming me into your head, so I appreciate it. It's a great show today. We're going to get to it in a minute. What you just heard was a little bit of Eric Cohen, who is the chief film critic and senior editor for IndieWire. He's also the manager of the CriticWire Network, and we'll talk about his roles there, as well as his history there, about his approach to writing and journalism and reviewing films. IndieWire is in the nerve center of independent film coverage in every manner of speaking. Eric is a delightful guy. I'm so thrilled to have had him on, and that he decided to come on, and he was looking forward to it, and he was very enthusiastic, and it means the world to me. Before we get to that, however, we're going to talk briefly to Ted Hope. I just Skyped with Ted because Fandor, who I partner with, they have a couple of brand new initiatives that I think are pretty germane to filmmakers, to independent film, to people that love independent cinema. So we're going to play that conversation in just a minute, and then we'll go into my conversation with Eric. And then, if that's not enough, bonus segment, there is a new documentary coming out shortly. In mid-August, I think it's coming out. I'm going to check my calendar here just to double-check so I don't flub this opportunity for these filmmakers here. I think it's on the 15th of August, if I'm not mistaken, here in New York anyway, A Will for the Woods. And I remember a pitch session where they were involved, the filmmakers. Two of the filmmakers, there's actually, let me take a step backward. A Will for the Woods is a documentary about green burial, environmentally responsible burial. And this is a documentary which probes that, as well as follows their primary subject, this guy who's dying of lymphoma and cancer. It's a great film. It's beautiful and it's inspiring, but it's also, there is a bit of a morbid strain in there too, I guess you could say. But see the movie; it's fantastic. There are four co-directors involved, but we're gonna have two of them on the show, and those two folks are Jeremy Kaplan and Amy Brown. And they'll be on a little later, too, as well. So first, let's get right away, without any further hesitation. This is a conversation with Ted Hope, who is the CEO of Fandor. And they have these two new initiatives that they just announced. And I want to talk to him about that, as well as the fact that he has a new book in the offing. And I hope to bring Ted on regularly, maybe like monthly. Okay, here's Ted Hope. Thanks for squeezing it in. I know it's a busy day.
Yeah.
The show that we did, the segment we did with you and Hal, I don't know exactly when that's going up, although I know it'll be soon. But I didn't want to lose the opportunity to act on these two initiatives. So I know that Fix is one of them. And when we did talk with Hal, you mentioned like you wanted Fandor to be a kind of a place where we could archive filmmakers, all their work, and be that resource for filmmakers. I wonder if this was part of that vision, or if this was sort of...
Yeah, you know, the question of how do we serve all of the different stakeholders, you know, that's a key issue for Fandor, you know, being a company that has, you know, is both in business, but has a mission, you know, that mission to be the the advancement and preservation of film art and culture for film lovers and makers. You know, we're trying to figure that out. And on the filmmaker side, you know, the dream of the digital archive, you know, is certainly on the horizon. But Fix is really the quicker reach, you know, something within reach right now. And that was to start to work with the filmmakers that we have direct relationships with, the filmmakers that we license content directly with, and start to provide them with new promotional opportunities and work with them to help their work get noticed. So like in the case of Barry Jenkins, it was to create the video essay by Kevin Lee that we did on his short film work. On the case of Hal, it was, you know, a little bit of theatrical. And in the case of all of them, it was, you know, building out their pages more fully, and there's more to come on that, as well as kind of putting the spotlight on them, you know. So there's much more that will come from that. But it's really, you know, kind of akin a bit to, you know, almost like what way record labels had artists and repertory A&R guys to kind of help their roster, as it were, to, you know, work well with the label and be able to get their work out. You know, I look at partially what we do, you know, like, we're not so much a distributor, you know, we're a platform and a service. So it's about helping to work with those filmmakers on how to use our platform well. And we're learning that too all the time.
Sure. You know, you mentioned the, you know, music industry and to some degree the distribution of film as well. As you, there's the cycle, you know, and it seems like once the cycle is reached its end, the film's, you know, it becomes less relevant. And what I like about, of course that's not my perspective and I doubt it's yours. I think that's just sort of the common perspective, you know, it becomes catalog and then it's out there. But what's nice about this is it kind of evens out the field a bit, you know, where it's all my content, it's all relevant. You can visit it however you wish, whenever you want. And, you know, it's all there, it's all relevant, it's all available.
I think you're onto something that's actually one of the kind of core differences of this moment that we're living in compared to what's come before, right? That the life cycle of a film, you know, historically what was just tiered to those first economic windows, right? The value of a film was often seen as its profit, that, you know, the revenue that it could generate. And I think that as we adopt culturally to this world of access and abundance and even distraction, you know, that the availability of everything, you know, online starts to require that we kind of recognize that we need to build into our work this constant, you know, rebirth, this way to have those, you know, the inciting events in the marketing side that kind of keeps films relevant. How do you tie past work into the present? And some of that, I think, comes from that understanding of the depth of somebody's work. The overall, where you see those references. And that's a bit of what we're trying to both learn how to do well and work with the filmmakers on how they can do better, you know. I think it really is not just looking at the new, but looking at, you know, what that conversation is, you know. And that's what we're going to kind of tease out, you know, each step of getting something up and running and then advancing it. It's very much about how do you maintain a relationship between an artist and an audience in an ongoing basis that becomes community. what do you need to do to really bring people together around an artist, you know? And I think we see a lot of that, certainly in the music business, although it remains heavily commoditized, you know, the kind of reissues, the back catalog, you know, in the film world, we historically have only seen it around the restoration of prints on like 25th anniversaries. But I think there's things that we need to do about how to loop things back into the dialogue, both of current events, you know, and of an artist's body of work.
Yeah, you know, a great example of that is we just posted, you know, the conversation I had with Joe Swanberg on Keyframe. So he has four films on Fandor at the moment, one of which is All the Light in the Sky, and then he has the trilogy, which kind of work as a group, you know? I mean, I don't know if he had envisioned it that way starting off. I don't know that he did, but certainly as he went on. And it gives it that context, too, which is another, I think, more fruit from this idea of and putting an artist's work on there. And, you know, for somebody like me, I if an artist has a weaker film, I don't look at it as a failure. I look at it in the context of their career. And we, you know, we have to look at the artist's their entire output of it to kind of judge them by. So,
yeah, and I think process is a really key piece. Like, if you look at the dialogue that you want to have happen over the life cycle of work, I think first it becomes, you know, the body of a filmmaker's work, and then comes how it relates, you know, to the culture at the time, other filmmakers' work and all of that. And alongside that then becomes like the moment of now, you know. But I think I really look forward to more of how does the Joe Swanberg relate to the Hal Hartley? How does the Hal Hartley, you know, relate to the Barry Jenkins? Like how does all of that start to...
How do they speak to each other?
Process? Yeah. You know, and for their sake, how can they benefit by what they've built and learned from each other? How can we, as a hub, help each of them achieve that network effect? You know, mm-hmm. that, you know, in some ways, the opposite goes on in all the other platforms, right? You just transition somebody to another person's film. But I think that there's more that we can do to kind of help when you're devoted to one artist to help them achieve that kind of escalation, you know, ripple effect by association with other artists or other themes.
And Fandor builds on the idea of community in the process.
And it's not an accident that we, you know, launched Fix on the same time that we announced the festival initiative. That, you know, they're very similar initiatives, you know, one looking at the film festivals, but how to also leverage their communal strength, and the other looking at the filmmakers. And then, of course, with each of them working, they can then start to work with each other better, too.
How do you approach all these festivals?
Again, we have a little bit of a luxury because, you know, we're not just, you know, about acquiring movies and acquiring subscribers, right? You know, that we really do see our value in the ecosystem at helping making all of that sustainable. How do we advance and preserve film, art, and culture, right? Mm-hmm. So on all of that, we look at what we've built, this great catalog of movies and a really accessible platform that isn't just films, but also provides context, you know, through things like Keyframe and, you know, your podcast and everything else. How do we do that? And then so how do we start with those existing assets and help these different stakeholders utilize them in ways that will advance their own missions themselves? And we believe that in the process, it will help us with those other core needs of ours, mm-hmm. revenue and subscribers, because they're all so closely related.
Well, it's all exciting to me.
Hey, I'm glad to get in and talk about it. But now I'm 7 minutes late for my next call.
Sorry about that. But I appreciate it. And we'll just try to do this every so often, maybe check in. You know, I think it'd be helpful.
Yeah, no, it'd be great.
But I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So I'll talk to you within a week or two about the book.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
So we'll have Ted on when the book comes out. It's called Hope for Film, and you can pre-order it now if you wish. I'm going to get a copy. I'm going to read it. This is very exciting. I sat with Eric Cohn. I went to the IndieWire offices about a week or two ago, and I sat with Eric. They are approaching their 18th anniversary. I believe they are doing a combination party and screening of A Girl Who Walks Home at Night Alone with Rooftop Films on the 18th. Go to rooftopfilms.com and find that screening. If there's any tickets available, you'll want to go. And there is a party for Rooftop Films and IndieWire. They share a birthday. They're both turning 18 this summer. And I'm going to try to get over there myself. So maybe I'll see you there. Here it is, my conversation with chief film critic at IndieWire, Eric Cohn. Thank you for coming on, Eric Cohn. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it was nice to run into you at the 4th of July barbecue.
Yep, over at Dan Nuxwell's house. It's a small world we live in.
It is. Yes, it's true. But I left there hurting. I stupidly started with their specialty cocktail, and then that was probably the biggest mistake of the day. Maybe the only one.
Right. Other than that, it was a great party.
Yeah. Because after that, I had some wine. It was just a disaster. I was like, the room was spinning. But anyway, I survived.
You're celebrating independence. Sometimes it's worth it to go to certain extremes to do so.
Yeah, if our forefathers could, it's the least we could do.
Right, exactly. I'm sure they did much worse.
You are the, correct me if I'm wrong, going by the website, the IndieWire website, but I think it labels you or calls you the chief film critic and senior editor and... Pregnant Pause, the manager of the Critic Wire.
Right. That list just keeps getting longer the more duties I take on. But originally I was called the lead film critic, and that was when it was actually a part-time job. And they changed it to chief film critic and senior editor when I came on board full-time, which was in 2010, because I do more than just manage our reviews. And then the Critic Wire Network, which is a big initiative for me, sort of our indie, I would say, sort of quote-unquote smart Rotten Tomatoes of sorts, a community for film critics, is something that I spend a lot of time on as well. Saying I'm the chief film critic is sort of a red herring, because I'm the only film critic, at least on staff, and we have various contributors who come and go. Handling the review side of IndieWire is this ever-changing process of sort of trying to just figure out, you know, what people want to read about in terms of, you know, the latest indie reviews as well as bigger releases when they fit into our wheelhouse. But I also work as an editor doing all kinds of different things, and I do some reporting and features work as well. So, you know, the title is relatively accurate in the sense that it encompasses the different categories.
It's a little bit of a catch-all, this senior editor. So you're writing, how many do you think about reviews are you sitting down to write in a week, do you think?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You know, I mean, the model for being a film critic used to be a very cut-and-dry sort of thing, in the sense that you would write, you know, maybe 3-4 reviews based on what happens to be opening, and, you know, it's a very clean task in that sense. It's not like that really for us anymore. I mean, there are so many movies that open each week, and I've experimented with the possibility of reviewing all of them with some sort of objective logic, the same way, say, The New York Times will review your movie if you play for 1 week in New York City. Mm-hmm. We had a capsule review column where we would just try to do that. And the legwork didn't really pay off, because one of the things that's interesting about being an editor, in addition to being a film critic, is that I look at traffic analytics, so I know how people respond to things. And nobody really likes to read that much information, especially when it's not substantial, because they're, you know, capsule reviews. So I review, I would say, 2-4 movies per week, but it really kind of depends, because a lot of that content that you see there is being repurposed, and you'll look at a review, say, of the Zach Braff movie that I reviewed this week, and there's a little disclaimer at the bottom that a version of this review ran during Sundance. So it's not a new review. So I actually produce most of my criticism at film festivals, at Sundance or at Cannes. I'll review it's up to 30 movies sometimes over the course of a 2-week period. And then those movies slowly find their ways into theaters, and we revisit them and repurpose them. And sometimes I get a chance to kind of, clean them up a little bit if I want to. But
I mean, there's a chance you might see a different cut.
Yeah, well, there's that, right? Too. And sometimes I will assign things to other writers who I think are better suited. For example, this week, the new Michel Gondry movie opened, Mood Indigo, which was 130 minutes when it opened in France. It's 96 minutes now for the U.S. cut. So I got Boy Van Hoy, who's a European writer and had actually reviewed the film for its French release, to revisit it, and he actually thought it was much better. So sometimes I'll do that sort of thing, and we'll have a couple contributors at film festivals, but it's very arbitrary. And one of the things I've realized is that criticism is arbitrary, and so you have to be kind of willing to evolve and meet different kinds of standards depending on what people want to read about in the moment.
Right, and you do develop that. That's kind of what your gift is, and the that you bring. You have a radar that kind of figure out which films are going to be of interest and or just that maybe germane in some level to the to the indie film zeitgeist that at that time.
Right. Like, well, it's not just that's nice for you to say. It's not just about determining what
it's
people
metrics,
want to know.
Literally from
I think it's understanding how to exploit them for your own gain or for the sake of advocating for things people wouldn't necessarily pay attention to.
That's cynical.
So
no, I'm kidding.
Well, actually, I think of it as the opposite of cynicism, because a lot of people tend to be very gloomy about the prospects of not just film criticism, but film culture in general, when you look at, how popular Transformers is or whatever. And, clearly, people are looking for those things and seeking out those things. But there is a certain kind of capacity to smuggle other things to people by virtue of the fact that we live in this click-frenzied culture in which, we're constantly being told, hey, look over here at this, cute cat video or whatever it is. There are various different iterations of that crass tendency that we all now possess, in terms of how we read things. And so when I'm reviewing things, I take all kinds of different, experiments to heart. The ability to write a snappy headline or to put something in certain kinds of terms, to break it up into subheads and talk about, not just whether or not this movie works, but other movies that are out there like it and how it has a certain kind of dialogue with them,
Context.
Yeah, context and just sort of trying to stand out in a marketplace of ideas that's more cluttered than it ever has been before. If anything, I think criticism is really valuable right now because there are just so many things that need to be curated. And to some degree, critics are curators. And if you're not seeing enough movies, I don't think you can really be whatever a professional film critic is now in the same way. It's just incredibly valuable to be familiar with the wide range of possibilities and to draw from those in such a way that you can create substance for someone out of, this huge mess of possibilities.
Right. IndieWire is about also bringing and explaining the state of the industry to those interested, the readers. And so, and I find that does that kind of finds its way into reviewing in your case, right? Because again, you're speaking to not only just the film, but in the context of the world that it exists in. And,
right. Well, I'm the first staff critic for IndieWire, and we didn't have a staff critic before I came along. But IndieWire has been around now for 18 years. Starting last week, actually, we're just as old as Rooftop Films, and so we have a joint birthday bash every summer. And this year, we'll be doing one on August 2nd, showing A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. So
one of my favorites of the year.
Yeah, no, it should be a great night. So I hope people really show up in full force for that one. But so the site started in 1996 as an email newsletter. Over the years, we started to have different kinds of critics who contributed. And for a little while, we outsourced to Reverse Shot, which is now going to be published by the Museum of Moving Image starting in the fall. But it never totally seemed like we had a consistent voice at IndieWire that could address what the rest of the site was doing, which was speaking to the needs of a very particular community, the indie film community, and also to bring that sensibility to a larger audience when possible. So my background is not just film criticism. I also have worked as a reporter, when I was a freelancer, I would do all kinds of different stuff. I would write features for the New York Times, you know. I mm-hmm. would do these Q&As for different places. I would write industry stories for Variety. I mean, I was wearing all these different hats, but really I felt like it was all coming from the same place, and I think it's essential that people bring those sensibilities to the table to really understand how this art form functions, because it's tied up in commerce and it's a collaborative medium that has all these different, you know, elements in play. So that really informs the way that I make certain kinds of decisions in terms of the things I think we should cover and the things that we discover. I talk to distributors and programmers in addition to publicists just to have a better understanding of, you know, when does a movie need to be singled out because it's not going to get singled out on its own. You know, there are certain times when it's important to bring something back into the conversation because, you know, if you wait until it's too late, you know, people won't have the same kind of opportunity to pay attention to it. So it really does, my understanding of how the indie film marketplace works really feeds into what I do as a film critic, as well as how I work as a reporter and all these other things, because again, it's all part of the same package.
So that you're saying the lines are obscured.
So for example, I thought that Snowpiercer was this great
glad you brought that
movie,
up.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
It's Bong Joon-ho is one of the best filmmakers working today. Certainly one of the best genre filmmakers of the last, you know, decade, let's say. And Snowpiercer is a really interesting movie that uses genre as sort of like a way of exploring these issues of class warfare and so forth in a way that's very entertaining, but also eccentric and disturbing in parts. The movie's kind of a mess, but it's this glorious mess, and, you know, class warfare is a mess, so in some ways it's appropriate. I think it's you look at it and you think it's all over the place, and then you realize, well, maybe it's meant to be that way, and he's completely in control of this really messy material. In any case, it's a fascinating movie. It went through a really interesting kind of public struggle with Harvey Weinstein, one of many we've heard of.
He wanted to cut it.
Right, he wanted to cut it down. And then it got passed to Radius, right? The division of the Weinstein Company that did a VOD release for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so the understanding the VOD marketplace is really important in understanding how this movie is being seen, right?
I'm glad you brought this up. Yeah, this is something I wanted to talk about with you.
It's actually very interesting. So Snowpiercer was actually released in 150, 250 theaters, something like that, the same weekend as Transformers, Age of Extinction opened on...
Probably many more screens.
3,000, something like that. Quite a few more.
Yeah.
So it's not really directly in competition with it, uh-huh. but clearly there was a very canny strategy on the part of Radius to release the movie then to create a certain kind of dialogue about the possibility of counter-programming, which is to say, specifically, if you have different kinds of sensibilities than this crass blockbuster tentpole, but you still like a fun, wacky summer movie, maybe you should pay attention to this better one.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding that argument mm-hmm. and why that's an interesting argument, I think, requires one step beyond just looking at the movie itself and to look at the dynamics of the film industry. So you can't compete with Transformers, but you can find ways to sort of utilize Transformers to create a different kind of audience. And the video on demand marketplace is one way to do that. So what was interesting about Snowpiercer is that it opened in a couple hundred theaters, and that strategy allowed for a certain kind of an awareness of this possibility. So it was very significant that the company then made a strategic decision to release the film on video on demand on iTunes and Vudu, all these other different places,
right.
2 weeks after it was in theaters. So the people were still talking about it, which meant this was a movie we could still talk about. So we covered Snowpiercer's VOD release, you know, after I had written about it from more of a critical standpoint, because I thought that was still sort of a way to extend the conversation about this movie that was very much worth covering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say this was Rage, the Nicolas Cage movie that was dumped on VOD last weekend that everyone seems to hate. I don't see any kind of reason to report
without
on this. Having like
seen
that.
It, probably too.
Most of us haven't, and nobody's really given us a reason to.
Right.
So, you know, it's important to jump on these stories from all kinds of different perspectives when the art itself gives you a reason to make a story out of it. And so that's really where all this is coming from. And so, frankly, I'd love to see more industry reporting that centers around, you know, quality cinema. And so that's really what we're trying to do, is to merge those tendencies, to look at what it means to release movies and program movies and curate movies and exhibit movies from the perspective of somebody who really cares about their quality.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Day and Date? Isn't it two completely different conversations when you're talking about indie films as opposed to larger tentpole films? I mean,
the interesting thing about Day and Date release is that it's almost a decade old now.
Yeah.
Really, because Steven Soderbergh's Bubble came out in around 2005, and that was the first real instance of a major film that was released that way. And if you look at the different kinds of approaches, there have been some really interesting experiments along the way, like when Wang Wang's Princess of Nebraska premiered on YouTube, or when Lars von Trier's Melancholia came out on VOD, Ultra VOD, so a month before it hit theaters. To see significant films that are released that way, you know that it's possible for films like this to actually succeed and get the exposure that they deserve. But what we don't know is exactly how successful they usually are. And that's because there's a lack of transparency to the VOD marketplace. We don't usually see the numbers for them unless they're really successful in the eyes of the distributor. So overall, I would say Day and Date, to me, if I were a filmmaker, as somebody who goes to film festivals and talks to both filmmakers and distributors and sales agents, I would want to capitalize on my exposure at a film festival, you know, because that's my audience. Those are the people who really care about movies, and I'm going to get all these reviews, and if it's a good movie, I'm going to get some good reviews. I would want my movie released, if not right then, you know, maybe a week later or something like that, because
there's a buzz already starting.
Otherwise, you start from scratch, and that never really made sense to me, because all of a sudden, you see a couple movies from this larger pool of possibilities that do well, you know, a year or 2 years after their festival premieres. But most stuff, you know, it just feels stale and it gets dumped.
Mm.
So Day and Date, to me, I think holds a tremendous amount of promise, but we're not really going to be able to see this model become the establishment until we report on how successful it has been.
That'll change. I mean, that's got to change. That's just
it's going to take a while.
There's resistance, I suppose.
There's a tremendous amount of resistance. I mean, if you look at the companies that release VOD numbers, Roadside Attraction still talks about how well Margin Call and Arbitrage did, you know, a couple years out, but they're not going to tell you about other stuff because sometimes those things do well and sometimes they don't do well. The other challenge involved in that is that you know, theater owners usually don't want to show movies that are on VOD because they think it's taking away their business. For other people, you know, it's the only way they're going to see certain movies that aren't coming to their neck of the woods.
Right.
So what ends up happening is that these movies tend to do pretty well on VOD, but by releasing those numbers, distributors are giving theater owners one more reason not to program movies that are available on VOD. And so the Snowpiercer thing was actually kind of interesting, was that, you know, more theaters than ever before were willing to show a movie that was on VOD, but still fewer people. And there's a war going on there where exhibitors, I think, are hesitant to commit to things when they know that they're going to lose business. Now, I think that theaters need to evolve to some degree to kind of eventize things more and kind of like create a sort of sense of specialness around the communal screening experience so that the theatrical model can kind of catch up with where people are at. Mm. But right now there's this kind of cold war going on, and so releasing the VOD numbers just complicates that equation one step further.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers are out there, and if you talk to people, you can get a sense for how it works. And I think it's fascinating because what you're seeing now is that cinephilia, or whatever you want to call it, people who are really interested in watching a lot of movies, they're doing it in ways that are still not known to the public, but everybody knows that they're happening because we all do it. So I think this is one of the best times ever to be, you know, sort of an enthusiast about the moving image, just because it's so available to us. And it's more available to more people.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you're a film lover or somebody who likes just experience a whole lot of different types of movies, there are so many options, especially if you're near an urban center.
Sure.
But I'm wondering, as a theater owner, an independent, I mean, for the few that are out there, you know, I could see they're in the hardest place, you know, obviously. And I don't know how they would eventize, it's the easier term, I don't know how they would do that when they really have an access to anybody out there, you know, to kind of create some sort of, you know, excitement around a screening of a relatively obscure indie film. But like, yeah. Snowpiercer seemed to be kind of in the best of both worlds, and it was certainly marketed as a big science fiction thing, and they weren't necessarily going to... I don't remember seeing by the, you know, in terms of broad marketing, you know, from the maker of Mother and, you know,
right.
and Memories of Murder or something. I don't see that because nobody cares about that. What right. they're more interested in is it's sort of science fiction, dystopic, you know, kind of.
Right. Well, you have to hone in on these elements that seem marketable.
I mean, right.
Boyhood is, I think, not so much being marketed as a Richard Linklater movie as it is this, you know, unprecedented 12-year in right. the making thing, and I think that's smart. You know, you have to sell people on what's different. Yeah. You know, yeah. why go out of your house to see something like that? You know, I mean, Boyhood's another movie where it's like it's only available in theaters, but I would love to see that be on VOD in 2 weeks also because yes, I think it would maximize sure. their profits, and certainly, you know, more people would tune in.
Yeah. Well, I would say though that Boyhood is that, whereas Snowpiercer is also is a mess, bigger, kind of has more stuff going on in it than just being like, you know, a fast train breaking through ice,
right.
you know, with a lot of slaughtering.
But the people who understand that are going to understand that and get that. I think yeah. the bigger challenge is those who make decisions very arbitrarily and, you know, getting people to just commit to seeing movies. You know, if you just play to that base... You know, that is people who know who Bong Joon-ho is or just, you know, would have some interest in this particular movie. You know, you're not going to have a very successful movie. And frankly, the bigger challenge is getting it to people who only might know that Transformers is out there. You know, that notion of sort of surprising people and saying, hey, you're interested in this kind of a movie? Well, I got something better for you. You know, that's really the accomplishment because everything else is just going to be there anyway.
Mm-hmm. You may even think you didn't. You may be confused by what you see, but the next day you might still be thinking about it.
Yeah,
whereas
exactly.
The headache wears off after you walk out of Transformers 4, and you know you've pretty much forgotten it at that point. I mean, so the headache lingering is probably you know the best you can hope for.
Yeah, and you know, look, I am not anti, you know. Mainstream in
no.
any sort of you
that's
know,
not what we're talking about.
You know,
yeah.
extreme way. Yeah, I mean, I think that. You know, I really enjoyed Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, for example. But I would say that the best aspects of mainstream entertainment are those that are not mainstream at all. You know, I like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes because, to some degree, it's actually an experimental movie that doesn't use dialogue for its first 15 minutes. And there's another movie called The Tribe that's coming out later this year that's all told in sign language. It's Ukrainian, and I saw a connection between what those two movies were doing, and that's exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well,
that's
an IndieWire article.
Yeah,
apparently
I did mention that, and I think that's what's interesting to me is that. Audiences are very interested in sophisticated cinema, even if they don't realize it. And so what I try to do is capitalize on that possibility and say,
yeah.
hey, you might actually like this movie, even though you never would have considered paying attention to it unless I told you about it. And then, you know, by virtue of presenting that possibility, it feels like you're actually opening people up to senses they didn't realize were there.
Right. So the bigger problem then is getting... people that aren't outside the choir to read you to read IndieWire, I mean, to make that information available so you can reach them in the first place, so you can tell them. By the way, there are these awesome alternatives. They just don't have the millions and millions of marketing budget dollars, rather, to get your attention. You know, quite
right.
the same way.
So there are a lot of different ways we package information. I mean.
Yeah.
People sometimes give us a hard time about lists, you know, of the sort that have been, you know, sort of perfected by BuzzFeed, but lists are very popular.
Mm-hmm.
I read a really interesting article where somebody said that for years, data associated with media consumption was a result of people lying, because you'd send surveys out to people, and they'd fill out, you know, what do you read? Well, everybody wants to say that they read, you know,
oh, yeah,
the
sure.
news, they read the foreign section, or, you know.
Descartes.
Right, exactly. If there was a Descartes page in
yeah.
the Times, everybody would say that was the first thing they read every morning. But now you can't lie because we see those numbers and we know that you're clicking on the quizzes and the lists and all that kind of stuff. And we've tried to kind of skirt that line without homogenizing our content. Some people, you know, freak out when they see that and they think, oh, we're not as serious or whatever. But the reality is what we're trying to do is just figure out, well, okay, what are you really going to pay attention to? We'll work within that dynamic, and then we'll bring you some stuff
right.
that you wouldn't necessarily know about otherwise.
Yeah.
So when we do our, you know, top, you know, but, you know, 15...
Oh, I see what you mean. No, 50, you're talking about like 15 top films that have been, you know, have had kids age or have people age, like you could have the...
Exactly, like those sort of things. Like we find these hooks of with new releases, you know, and things like that, and tend to capitalize on that sort of thing. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think that's, you know, that's what's really interesting is that we're more consumer-facing than we used to be. When I first started contributing to IndieWire, it really was designed almost like as a community newsletter, and I don't mean that as a pejorative. It was just
like a trade.
Really, it was like a trade, but it was for such a specific world. You know, those people who there's a whole industry surrounding film festivals and you know, curation of indie cinema and so forth. Right, that's a very particular business and a very particular world that surrounds it. And IndieWire only spoke to that world. It was like the kind of mouthpiece for that world, and I think we still are. But what we're doing is we've added a filter to it that magnifies it so that other people can discover that as well. And so there's more kind of gateways into that conversation, whereas the foundation has remained in place the whole time.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is really valuable because, again, it's a very cluttered marketplace. I mean, to go back to, you know, it's ridiculous that the New York Times reviews so many movies each week, but it does allow us to track how many movies come out. And last year, I think they reviewed 900 movies or something like that. And it's like, that's just crazy. Like, there's that much stuff out there. And, like, most people are just paying attention to, you know, whatever.
Distributed, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. My favorite part of our year-end critics poll is our undistributed films list. I track what doesn't have distribution throughout the year. A lot of critics don't know. And I think that's a problem because you need to know about these things in order to understand where cinema is in relation to your enthusiasm for it and other people's enthusiasm for it, and how can you meet people halfway to have some modicum of an impact on how film culture operates on a mainstream scale.
Yeah, and the places where it used to exist, there were a few places where you could get an idea about undistributed films are kind of gone. Even like, you know, I was talking to somebody recently, they said, they reminded me that the best, you know, the movie that's not playing at your theater. What was the name of that award that they were giving out at this?
Best movie was not coming to a theater near you. Yeah, the Gotham.
Yeah, that's gone. And there was another such list somewhere about undistributed. Probably Filmmakers Magazine still brings some attention to that. But right. You're right.
Well, yeah. So we still do it at the end of every year, and you know, it ends up being a longer list.
Let me ask you about, you brought up Boyhood a little bit back, and everybody sort of jumped on board with this film, almost without exception. I have not read a negative review of it, if it's out there.
Clearly don't read Armand White.
Oh, thank you.
Unless that doesn't count as a review. Everybody has their own opinion.
Yeah.
I always find him to be interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't, if he's listening, I won't be able to get him on. Well, no, maybe I have to insult him in order for him to come on. Maybe that same idea.
You wait until you're sitting across the table from him, and then you can say whatever you want, but he can come back at you. So, it's all about the two-way street. If we're going to go down that street, I actually like Armand. I think he's a...
In person,
he's a really great guy. He's writing, you know... I mean, sometimes I wish an editor would rein in some of the ideas because I think they come from a real place, and sometimes the arguments are interesting. The problem is that there are some sort of weird tangents in there, some ways that are designed to kind of like trumpet a certain point of view, but can also distract or deaden the argument to some degree or weaken it. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder to take him seriously when he's just sort of insulting film culture at large. And then, you know, you read it and you're like, is he insulting me? Because I was really with that argument until he just, completely like...
Well, if you're looking for a thank you, you're not going to get one.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Kind of the mindset.
So, I mean, you know, but Armand made some interesting points about Boyhood, calling it sort of dull and that there's like a sort of hip quotient to supporting a movie like this, and you can't negate that.
Right. I do want to ask about it because I was thinking... while I was, of course, blown away also by the magnitude of it and the scale and the success of having accomplished it, but I was also thinking, what if you had taken out what is essentially a device or a gimmick in the sense of what if you had used, like they typically do, four actors to play
Mason?
Right.
If it was shot in a couple of months instead of 12 years?
Yeah, just right, using different actors as they usually do in a movie like this. And I was wondering if it would have had would people make of the movie? Would it still be such a favorite, or is it because it was such a feat? You know, there is something really astonishing and emotionally connective about seeing somebody grow up in front of your eyes, and that that in itself is something that's legitimate. You know, even if it is a gimmick, because it's a pretty powerful thing to put up on the screen. We don't see that except for maybe like the 7-Up series.
I think you made a good point, although 7-Up isn't really comparable because it's a series of movies.
Yeah, but the device is the same.
Right.
And I go and I'm moved not by this particular film, that segment necessarily. There have been ones that are weaker than others just because of it's just not an exciting moment in this type of. But I'm usually in tears or moved by that I've been along on this. You know, emotionally, I've invested in these people
right.
over now.
Sure.
You know,
and it's a real investment, and these are real people.
Yeah,
I think with Boyhood, it does change the terms a little bit in terms of how you talk about a certain movie working or not working. The thing that I wrote in my review out of Sundance, which I completed around 4 a.m. after the premiere, given that in that environment you have to file on these really tight deadlines. Otherwise, you know, it's old news by tomorrow. I mean, that's not entirely true because I could revisit it, but it was a hell of a thing to deal with, you know, sort of responding to that movie in that environment under deadline. And so I did take my time and I spent several hours on it. And what I said at the beginning, and I stand by, is that if there was ever a movie that is informed by the story of its making, this is it. And the reason I think that's the case is because not only is it impressive that he pulled it off, but knowing that he's pulling it off as you watch the movie creates a certain narrative about the creativity involved in the project. So I don't think this is just a movie about the passage of time or about what it means to grow up and have a certain relationship for certain memories. It's about the very notion of a creative challenge in a time when it's more difficult than ever to come up with original ideas. And it's constantly trying to work within certain expectations and transcend them. So each chapter is not that interesting, but as a whole, you are seeing real time pass. And knowing that, when you see certain things that come up later in the movie that are relating to earlier points in time, or you realize that you're looking at the same physical face in close-up, but it's fundamentally different, you are seeing what time does in a very real way that is only enabled by the commitment of making this movie happen. So you feel like you're in this marathon with Linkletter and all these people, and you actually experience the time of the film and the production process. And so I think to some degree it's a narrative of its own making.
You liked it?
I liked it. I did like this movie, but I will say, you know, it's not the easiest thing to commit to, and I think you know, it has flaws, and some of the flaws are interesting and worth talking about. You know, certain random characters who come up that feel a little underdeveloped, and you know, to me, it's not so much about being enthusiastic about this movie as it is digging into it and seeing what's interesting about it. So, you know, I'm excited about movies that have all kinds of problems in similar ways. So.
Yeah, yeah, and the best movies do.
Yeah.
So let me just ask, as we wind down, I guess, not an hour, but which area do you think will probably change the most in... this is the list question, I guess, because going back to lists. Acquisition, distribution, or exhibition?
So the top three things that are going to change about
well,
the
or even just as far as for independent films. I mean, I'm talking primarily since that's kind of both of our wheelhouse.
Acquisition, you know? Distribution,
you
said?
Exhibition.
An exhibition. Which one's going to change the most?
Or you don't have to really answer that literally. Maybe they're converging, and they are certainly. If you just today, Fandor, you know, which is, of course, CEO is Ted Hope, and he's somebody who's definitely coming from distribution, but now is also very interested in exhibition, and part of that is acquiring films.
Right.
So maybe there is a blur. Maybe that's the result. Because Fandor seems to, even though they are, by disclaimer, a sponsor of this show, but they did make some announcements today, for instance, which is putting themselves out there more as a community and as a place for, you know, filmmakers and audiences to come together and you know, share in this independent film
I like Spandor and I like Ted Hope. I mean, whether or not that company is successful as a business, I don't know. I mean, I think that's sort of the interesting question. You know, it's like it's one thing to do something and seem sort of cool and stand out. It's another thing to actually be successful, and that opens up a whole can of worms about, you know, profits and these hazy VOD numbers we talked about before. The thing that I think is going to change the most is the way that we pay attention to media as a whole, I think, is all kind of blended together. I'm a big fan of Henry Jenkins, the professor who coined the term transmedia, and whereas transmedia is kind of this weird, expansive term, he wrote a great book called Convergence Culture, which is essentially about how all media is converging, and it has been for a very long time. And some of the examples he uses, you know, they're not like the best forms of art that we've seen over the past, you know, 100 years, but I think that there's some really interesting case studies about the way in which we are presented with narratives that have many different strands. So, for example, the Matrix trilogy, right? Matrix 3, I think that was Revolutions, I get them confused, didn't really work. But it worked better if you also read the comic book and played the video game. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more we have certain sensibilities in which there are bigger narratives that determine how we process media and how we determine quality. And that's going to inform every element, including not just how we tell stories, but how we release them. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think things like day and date releasing are important, because it allows you to have many different ways to encounter this one particular object. Right. Yeah. And I think the conversations about things are important in that regard, because, you know, whether or not, you know, the Twitter stream associated with a movie is actually a part of that movie, it does have a bearing on how you perceive that that product. And so I think, you know, to go back to that list that you just presented, I would say that distribution is what's going to change the most, because we're going to see a broader gulf between the way that studios release movies and the way everything else gets released. We're already seeing it. And eventually the studios are going to have to adapt to that model as well. So we'll see shorter windows in between mainstream releases and when they're available on VOD. And that's going to have a trickle-down effect to everything. So the new paradigm will be largely watching things on your own time, on your great home theatrical setup. And movie theaters are going to be a special place for special kinds of experiences. And that, to me, is great, because it gives everybody what they need. Theater owners are going to keep struggling, but, you know, none of us would be doing this stuff if the only bottom line was just to get rich. You know, some people do better than others. The bottom line is we're doing it because we're into it, and we want to program great stuff, and we want people to be satisfied with the products that they have available to them. So I think overall distribution is going to continue to adapt to the sensibilities of people who really want stuff how they want it. And that kind of on-demand culture is already here, and the business model is just, you know, a few steps behind it. So soon enough, we'll see all this stuff settle.
Thank you for coming on and talking about it.
That's my pleasure. I love this podcast. So. Oh,
thank you. Yeah, and I've been listening. You're doing one with Anne.
Screen Talk Thompson. Every Friday. Yeah,
every Friday we're gonna let people know about that. I'll put that on our website too. I need to catch up with that.
Yeah, check it out. We got 6 episodes so far. It's me and Ann Thompson, who's the proprietor of our Thompson on Hollywood blog and our large and IndieWire. So we talk about indie film news and new releases.
Similar conversations.
Stuff kind of like this.
With a much smarter person.
Well, you know, it's all relative.
Yeah.
Well, and I like to fight, so the tenor of the conversation is a little different.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, yeah. I do appreciate that. So you'll maybe come on and fight with me sometime.
Anytime.
I welcome you back, and thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure.
The problem with doing an audio podcast, by the way, is you can't have like on 20 people on one time. You can do that on TV, but you can't really do it on a podcast because it just becomes confusing. I mean, even if you I've had on episodes where, you know, I've had on 4 guests at one time, and that is just, it's too confusing for listeners, I think. So when it came to A Will for the Woods, rather than miss the opportunity of talking about this very, very amazing documentary, I said, let's just get on 2 of you guys. You fight it out, and the 2 of you, it turns out the 2 losers came on the show. No, I'm kidding. But Jeremy Kaplan and Amy Brown are both came on the show, and this is my conversation with them. I do want to make sure I give credit, though, to the other two filmmakers, Brian Wilson and Tony Hale, for their contribution, of course, and I hope to have those two gentlemen on the show eventually, of course. So here's my conversation with Jeremy and Amy about their new film, A Will for the Woods.
That they were going to clear the woods to make another lawn, but they decided to keep the woods, and now it's their green burial woods.
Oh, really?
We saved a tract of forest by doing that.
So now that will always stay forest.
I'm Clark. I'm a psychiatrist, and I was diagnosed with lymphoma 7 years ago. That led to an increased awareness about the importance of the environment in general. Although I'm trying to overcome it, the reality is that a burial is a very likely outcome. I'd like to use whatever time I have left to help set a pattern in our community of going back to really traditional and natural ways of handling our dead.
Good, you're a man and a woman, so that people have an easier time discerning the voices. And welcome to Filmwax Radio. Finally, the whole journey, I've seen it from the beginning pitch to its culmination in a theatrical now coming up in a few days.
Yeah.
Amy Brown and Jeremy Kaplan, two of the four filmmakers, right behind A Will for the Woods.
That's right. Yep.
So welcome, both of you. This is about the green burial movement, and which is still rather, I would say, mostly unknown part of the burial business overall, right? But yours focuses on that, in the forefront is a particular guy, Clark Wang, is that his name? Clark Wang, who is been exploring this. He's got lymphoma, he's dying. And so he explores the green burial option, right? And through his story, we also learn more about the environmental side of the story, et cetera, correct? So, and Amy, you first learned about this through a conversation with her sister or something like that? What was that?
Right. She was working with a professor of the University of Melbourne in Australia.
From whence you hail?
From whence I hail.
Was that right? Okay.
From whence, yeah.
Is it whence or where? I don't know. Whence? Is that when? Or is that... We need an English professor from Melbourne as well. But anyway, you're from Australia.
I am from Australia.
Don't try to hide it.
Right. Am I sounding like...
No.
Sometimes when I hear my voice, I'm like, gosh, I sound like an American. Where did that come from?
I don't know, but that maybe we can explore that later.
Yeah.
It actually happens to me too when I'm talking to somebody. I'm like, I sometimes will take on their accent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange thing, but I've always had that fascination for the accent. But,
right.
But again, that's another segment.
Need to fit in.
And we should say from the very top also, if you're living in New York, you have an. We will have, you guys are having a theatrical next Friday.
August 15th.
August 15th. August
right. 15th. Well, we're actually going to get out on our bikes and litter the city as much as we can. Not
okay.
Litter the city. That's not really a very good...
That's not very...
But we have a new poster coming out.
Oh,
so
very nice.
I'm really excited to post that on all the bike shares and take it to farmers markets and take it to the spots where we think people...
Cemetery entrances.
Cemetery
gates.
Entrances, yes.
For
that's
one thing.
A good idea.
Yes.
We're going to have a hybrid hearse, perhaps, in Union Square.
You were beginning to tell me about your sister, though, and then how she had a professor in Melbourne. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. He sort of had the idea independently of knowing about the movement and enlisted Sophie to help him with research and to create sort of an educational packet if someone was to want to start a green burial site in Australia. So she was working on it over the course of a few years, and she came to visit me in New York, and we took a road trip over Van Wyck Expressway over
beautiful Van Wyck.
Yeah, Calvary Cemetery, and it was just a very, you know, heavily entombed conventional cemetery. And
yeah, you could also drive down. I apologize for interrupting, but you could also drive down the Jackie Robinson or along Metropolitan Avenue in Queens. I mean, they're just, which I guess are the same cemeteries now that I think about it. They're just flanking, but there's just tons of cemeteries in Queens.
Right. If you look at a map of Queens, it's like it's not green space on the map. It's like gray space on the map. And you just think, like, had this been green burial grounds, it would be park space and multi-use areas.
Yeah.
That would be much more, you know, appealing for people to spend some time.
I mean, if you look how that all those cemeteries cut through the center of Queens right down to Brooklyn for pretty much that, if that were all park, how many more people in these neighborhoods would have access to green space, you know?
I've
always felt that it's a horrible use. I don't get it. I'm a sentimental person and sensitive guy. You know, I do feel sensitive. It would be nice to visit, to sort of be able to visit. This is just a horrible use of land. I don't know who came up with the idea. Jeremy, you have an idea about that?
The really interesting thing, actually, is that Greenwood Cemetery, which is a lovely cemetery
in Brooklyn
that a lot of people go to and actually spend time in
Sunset Park
and take walks. And actually now I'll be living a few blocks from it, which is very fitting. But that was actually one of the first cemeteries that was thought of as park space, and actually was the impetus for Central Park. It existed before Central Park.
Well, that makes sense.
And what's really fascinating about it is that, so in a way you could say these cemeteries, Greenwood Cemetery, Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we actually played the film there, they're all sort of the original ideas for this notion of cemeteries as being more than just a space where every once in a while someone comes to remember a person. But it's got natural habitat. People can walk there, take strolls, hikes. And the thing is, the difference now with this new version of green cemeteries is really that the habitat is left untouched. And actually, sometimes the habitat is restored. And so, you know, there's no semblance of tombstones that are very recognizable. If there are any tombstones, they're very small little field stones. And a lot of times they're natural, sort of, a marker might be a natural plant.
Right. But how do they, over time, keep track if, like, it's a stone or if it's a marker? I'm sorry, plant. I mean, how did the family find it?
It's
over, like, 30 years or something.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing is, I mean, some of the sites actually, the cemetery itself has a map, and sometimes they have sort of a, you know, whether it's just a basic map where they have all the plots set, or they even have GPS coordinates of them.
That's smart.
Yeah, so the cemetery always keeps the coordinates because they have to also, you know, make sure they know how many plots are available and all of that. But the families themselves, a lot of people... some cemeteries, green cemeteries, actually have markers that they want to biodegrade, that they don't want to exist for as long as possible. And then the thing is, there's a lot of these beautiful field stones that will last a while. You know, they're sort of like indigenous rock from that area, and they'll be around
they're dug into the ground, in other words.
Yeah, they lay sort of flat. They don't really go into the ground. They just sit on top of it.
Okay.
And so you can see in the film, there's some beautiful cemeteries that we show, like Ramsey Creek, which is in South Carolina. And they have these really gorgeous trails, and you walk along them. And you can almost, you know, hike for, you know, about half a mile and not even notice that you're in a cemetery. But if you pay enough attention in between brush and things along the hike, you'll see these little field stones. Mm-hmm. And there'll be person's name and the date. And sometimes people don't even have that. They'll just have their name and a quote. There's a beautiful tombstone that just says, what is it? Thank you.
Dear Nature.
Thank you, Evelyn. And that's all it has on that.
Did it respond? That was the bigger question. Anyway, so how many cemeteries, green cemeteries, do we know about that exist in, at least in the United States?
The count at the moment is 42 that are Green Burial Council approved. That's a certification program to make sure that they're adhering to certain standards, environmental standards. But total, there's just over 100.
Oh, so there's
in
over,
the U.S.
Half of them, in other words, that half are, a little over half are just they're just
doing
sort
it
of,
themselves, and right. And then in the U.K. there's over 300.
Oh, so it's taken off much more in
it
the
started
UK,
in
a much smaller country, but many more.
Right, and the cemeteries are much smaller too.
Right.
What the U.S. brought to this movement was the conservation element. So the sites in the U.S., because there's much more land here, are, you know, endeavoring to save hundreds of acres, whereas in the U.K. that's not really possible.
Right. Also, you know, cities are, you know, the precious, I mean, it's precious land
right.
as opposed to, like, you know, Montana or, you know, even in the Carolinas, they're probably less kind of concerned about space as much as like we are in a big city like New York City or just any city, you know.
Exactly.
And also where there's enough pollution here, right? So the conventional burial process and even cremation both are leave a larger carbon footprint. They're both, right? They both emit pollutants or create pollutants.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Into the environment.
That was something in our research that was pretty staggering to me, just to think of the millions of tons of carbon that's emitted through cremation every year across the world, and just how that's rising all the time. You know, the cremation rate is now 80% in most states in America. And a lot of people think that with cremation that they're saving land, they're not wasting it, and it's the environmental thing to do. But actually, you're emitting and you're using energy, and with green burial, you're conserving land, so you're not wasting it. And then the conventional burial industry uses a lot of resources and just puts them in the ground, and lawn care and all that kind of stuff is pretty resource intensive. Formaldehyde from embalming.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I always thought, oh, yeah, you know, throw me into the ocean, that kind of thing. But it's like that part of it is probably the least of it. It's the cremation process itself, right? Yeah.
Right.
So how did you meet the main subject of the film, Clark Wang? He's a very sensitive, thoughtful person and seems really brave and has a lot of integrity. At least that's what I gather from watching him and getting to know him a little.
Yeah, well, we were incredibly lucky to meet Clark. Joe Sihe, who's the head of the Green Burial Council, we were filming with him, and he knew Clark as Clark had reached out to him to help him find a green burial ground in North Carolina where he lived. And when we first met Joe, he mentioned Clark, and he mentioned this charismatic, articulate, intelligent doctor who was living with cancer, but it seemed terminal, even though he was fighting to beat it, and that we should connect with him one day. Mm-hmm. And then one evening, after we'd been filming with Joe for about 3 months, he called and he said, Clark's health has taken a turn for the worst, and I think you should reach out now. So I gave Clark a call and spent hours on the phone just chatting about movement and the film and everything, and we went down to North Carolina shortly after that. Mm-hmm. And filmed with him thinking we were just going to do an interview and a couple of, you know, follow him around for a day or two, and very quickly realized that he was just so compelling and he wanted to share his story so much, and he invited us into his life and into his whole world. And from the first morning, it was, you know, back-to-back things of radiation and going to visit his green burial plot and visiting his casket for the first time. And it was...
He lay in it.
Right.
You know, didn't he? Like
he tried it on for size, yeah. And then he danced on top of it.
Oh, well, that's good.
That was a really amazing moment. And I don't think when we got there, I don't know, Clark didn't know how he would react to that situation. And I think it was one of those things that was sort of like this very defiant act for him. It helped him to sort of like put a light touch on the whole situation. And that was one of the wonderful things about Clark throughout the whole process of coming to grasp with his own mortality, was that he always had this beautiful sense of humor. And so for him, it was like, he had this terminal lymphoma, and he knew eventually it was going to happen, and he thought he could make the best out of it by sure. becoming an advocate for Green Burial, and also by opening up this whole his whole process. So like he wrote and blogged a lot about his health situation, about Green Burial, and so lots of people in his community and people outside of his community started following his story. And so it was really wonderful in the course of filming to sort of see Clark's influence as an advocate for Green Burial and within his community and outside of the community. And he really provided a big spark for a lot of people in the Green Burial movement, people who are home funeral celebrants and people who run cemeteries and stuff. Wherever we go to interview people, they'd start to bring up Clark and say about how they were inspired by his story.
Yeah, I mean, so this is just in the end, a documentary about a very compelling individual, as well as a compelling issue. But the film, again, is called A Will for the Woods, and it's going to have a theatrical week, at least a week, I hope. Maybe they'll extend it if you come out, if you're listening. Tell me which theater it's at.
At the Village East.
The Village East on 2nd Avenue in the Village?
Yes, yeah. 2nd Avenue.
2nd Avenue and 11th or something. And it's going to be there starting August the 15th. Spread the word. Now, you two guys are just 50% of the filmmaking team. Can you talk a little bit, who are the other two filmmakers on this large team of directors? And why, indeed,
it's like a family.
How did you decide that you're all going to take director's credit or share director's credit? And why did you need to do this? And how did you split up those duties? I mean, I'm kind of curious because this might be the first time I've run into a film with four directors, co-directors.
Yeah. And in a way, I think it's a very unique and close relationship that we've all had to each other. So it made perfect sense for us all to be co-directors, but it kind of happened organically. Amy started out with the idea coming from her sister. And Amy and I actually met at the New School. I had a friend who was taking a class with Amy. I had just graduated from the New School, the Master's in Media Studies, and Amy had pitched a short film about Green Burial. And so from that, we started to just work on, I was really fascinated with the idea, and we thought, let's start filming and see where this goes, not really assuming that it could be a feature film. And in the course of shooting it, and Amy and I going on the road and following Joe, then finding Clark, about a year and a half into it, we figured we needed to start editing stuff. And we had put together a few pieces on our own, but I have a really good friend of mine, Tony Hale, who came on to the project, and he's one of the co-directors.
Tony Hale?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
And so it's Tony Hale and Brian Wilson. Both of them are editors.
He's got some great albums, that guy, by the way, just so... And Tony Hale is great on the Arrested Development.
Yeah, I know.
It's quite a versatile group here.
No wonder
they're not available.
Yeah, exactly. They've got a lot of other things to do.
Between their movies and albums, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
so it helps with the film. You know, they do a lot of publicity for it. But yeah, the two of them are just really wonderful editors. And we felt like Tony, I'd known for a long time, and we had worked together on other projects and stuff, and he was basically the only person that I thought would be perfect for this, to edit the film and work on it. So they both took on such huge responsibilities in the course of, you know, we actually shot for another year and a half, and they had already started to compile footage. So we actually spent about a year and a half where we would come and meet and pull together selects and while we were still shooting. And so we had this sort of wonderful process of being able to roughly define the structure of the film in the process of still having a good deal of the film to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So in the course of that, we would, a lot of times, people would get certain sections of the film that we thought would be relevant. And so Tony would go off, or Brian would go off, or Amy would go off, or I would go off with some footage and edit scenes and some ideas, and we'd all come and meet and sort of brainstorm and have sort of editing sessions where we'd put out there like what storylines were applicable and what was really intriguing. And so in a way, it became this very democratic process of editing. And also at the same time, what was great was that as editors, they had a lot to influence on what we're shooting too. And since I was, since we were shooting, it was easy to, and editing at the same time, it was easy to go out into the field and be like, you know what, we need this scene, or we need some sort of way to explain this aspect of Green Burial. And so in a way, as much as the film is entirely verite, for the most part, there's very little interview. There's ways in which we were able to sort of construct the film in a much more kind of a narrative sense, in a way. And the film really does sort of have a very strong arc. And part of that is just because of Clark's story and his predicament. But in a way, part of it is also from this editing and shooting process that was kind of happening simultaneously.
And you had your New York premiere at DocNYC last fall, correct?
Yeah, and that was such a fantastic screening. We had our world premiere actually at Full Frame mm-hmm. in North Carolina, mm-hmm. and that was
pretty close
wonderful.
Pretty close to where a good portion of the film takes place, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, it was basically coming to, we called it our second home, but it was quite a screening, emotional screening the first time.
Did his wife come and family and friends and all?
Yeah, yeah, his partner Jane.
Folk dancers and nurses and colleagues.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it was quite a crowd that, you know, sold out. And A good chunk of the people there had some relationship to Clark, or didn't know Clark personally, but had heard of his mm-hmm. story mm-hmm. and were inspired by him. And it was probably the most emotional Q&A we've had.
Sure.
They had to kick us off because it was like going on an hour long.
Oh,
people
wow.
just wanted to talk about Clark and how much he was an inspiration to them. And it was a wonderful experience. And the beautiful part about it was because of that, also we won the audience award at Full Frame, which was really nice. And also the environmental award as well, too. So it was really fitting to sort of honor Clark close to the two-year anniversary of his death, right around Full Frame. And then to get all this attention and his community to sort of honor him and celebrate him. So it was wonderful.
Do you think that played into any part of Full Frame's decision to program the film?
I would think so. I think, you know, they do have a good amount of, a few sort of North Carolina-based films, but
okay.
I think they really, really love the film.
I mean, how many cigarette documentaries can you make, for God's sake? You know, like, or a program.
Yeah.
So I'm sure, you know,
yeah,
Ross
McAwee has already made a few, so.
He's been on this podcast.
Yeah.
Amy, so did you get, I forget, how did you finance the film?
Because
it went on for a few years, it sounds like.
Right. We self-financed initially, mm-hmm. And we just kept the costs down. Like, we were busing everywhere. It was mm-hmm. Jeremy and I. We bought a secondhand camera and sound equipment.
But what about all the CGI? How did you pay for that?
Right, exactly. All the, like, amazing sound effects and stuff. Well, and we ran a Kickstarter that uh-huh. was really successful and raised a lot of money, and that sort of, we built in our distribution through that as well, by selling community screening licenses and the DVD and things like that. And we also had some investors
mm-hmm.
from the industry, from the Green Burial movement and outside of it too.
Oh, okay. Will you have institutional distribution as well? Because it seems like it would be a good tool.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had a lot of people
from the
Green Burial movement, from the hospice movement, the whole holistic sort of end of life, home funeral movement, hosting screenings and.
Right. This would make sense, right? So it's just you're having one. Is it just this one theatrical, or do you have?
We're playing in Portland and Boston and Texas and Baltimore, Seattle, hopefully LA.
Back in Durham.
Yeah, we're
sure.
bringing it back on the weekend of Halloween and the Day of the Dead. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh wow. That'll be nice.
Yeah, that'll be sort of the bookend of the end
It'll
of the tour.
It'll be back at the theater that Full Frame uses. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. I've been, you know, keeping tabs on you and the film for a couple of years now, so it's nice when it does come full circle like this, and that people have an opportunity to finally see this compelling story. And, thanks. I'm glad this
Yeah, thank exactly. you. It's been so lovely to have you along the way.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Pass along my regards to Tony and to Brian, too. And
absolutely.
We'll have one eventually. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, we've got quite a few things. Started sort of interviewing filmmakers for a second podcast. It's on the Kino Lorber website. I think in the next few days it should be up, if it's not up. And, of course, the first interview is with Alex Gibney, a very prolific filmmaker. He has a new documentary coming out this Friday. It's called Finding Fella. And I interviewed Alex Gibney. It was a thrill. And I think it came out really, really well. It came out exceptionally well. He was very available and open, and we talked for at least a half hour, maybe closer to 35, 40 minutes, and you'll get to hear that. I'm going to put it on the this podcast shortly. But coming up also in the next couple of shows, I'm doing a show. The next podcast also will have Dan Krause, who has a new documentary coming out. It's already started coming out. I think it's already out in New York, but it's coming out in Los Angeles and San Francisco in the coming weeks. And that's called The Kill Team. And I'm sure if you're into documentary films, you've read about it. It's had quite a bit of a trajectory. And Dan Krause, the filmmaker for that, is coming on the show. I just had on the filmmaker Jennifer Kroot, who made the documentary To Be Decay, about George Takei. And I wanted to have George on, and I'm hoping to still squeeze in a brief interview with him, Captain Sulu himself. There wasn't time today to do it. So it doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It just means I got to be patient about it. And then also coming up in the next few weeks, my conversation with Dan Schechter, who has a new film coming out. It's an adaptation of an Elmore Leonard novel, and the movie's called Life of Crime, and it is spectacular. It is really, really good. So that's coming up. And then I also had a recently conversation with the great editor Sam Pollard, and I'm going to be putting that up shortly. So, and of course, much, much more. Right, guys? Tons of conversations coming at you all the time here on FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. This is Adam Chartoff wishing you well. Until next time.
Call me back tomorrow. Today is not so good. I'm in a bad place in my head, and I can't get out of bed. If I pull myself together, it wouldn't mean a thing. I've always been the one who finds a way to turn it around when I'm going down that road. Today and tomorrow, still so unpredictable. I'm either setting myself or pulling out. If I pull myself together like a pair of open scissors in a room of paper dolls, my eyes stay glued to the wall. I'm going.